not to attend certain social events and family gatherings. I am hoping that as we begin to come out of this time, that I can still treasure and protect some of what I've learned and experienced during this past year. And I thought it would be valuable to share with you a story from the Book of Serenity, the 21st case of the Book of Serenity, translated by Thomas Cleary. Very well-known story. Yunnan was sweeping the ground. Dao Wu said, "Too busy." Yunnan said, "You know there is one who is not busy." This is one of those Zen stories that I heard early in my monastic practice at Tassajara, where I first met Jim and Karen. And it's one of those stories that once I'd heard it, continued to, you know, now and then just spontaneously arise like a flash in the middle of my busy modern life. Who is this one that Yunnan speaks of, the one who is not busy? These quirky Zen stories are there to help us in a kind of non-rational way, a way that's really outside of our conventional concepts. But I think this story does tell me that in the midst of my busyness, I can sense one within me who is not busy, what I think of as a compassionate witness that's with me always. Zen practice encourages us to merge with our activity. And one of my favorite things about being at Tassajara Monastery was just the physical labor of cooking and gardening. And I laid a brick path there without having the slightest idea what I was doing, cleaning the baths, you know, this physical work where I could let go of the painful boundaries of self and open to a different kind of reality. Yunnan is sweeping, which is a classic Zen activity. You often see Japanese woodblocks of monks sweeping or, you know, raking the gravel in front of a temple. When we're completely immersed in our activity, there is no busyness. There is no self. There's just sweeping. And I find there's a kind of ease and joy in just entering right here and being aligned with our real life, which is nowhere, if not right here, right now. This strange year of intermittent shutdown has given this teaching about Yunnan new meaning for me. During this time, many of us, I think, have come back to us at least a sense of elemental life, limiting our exposure to the world, limiting social engagement, cleaning out that storage area that we've been meaning to get around to, and finding joy in the activities, simple activities that we can do at home, either by ourselves or with people that we love, things that at one time we might have enjoyed but let go of because of other commitments and responsibilities, because of our chronic busyness. When we're at one with our activity, there's this sense of freedom from the bondage of self and a kind of respite from the pressure of busyness. When I look back before our self-imposed quarantine, many of us were juggling with work, social and family life, trying to be active in our communities, serving on committees and boards, trying to find a time to exercise, doing community service, and many of us also caring for young children or for elderly parents. And I think there can be a kind of addiction to this kind of busyness. And I hope that as things start to open up, we can remember to treasure the kind of quiet time and solitude that, you know, has been forced on us, you know, during this year, and continue to examine our addiction to busyness as we become more busy again. I say addiction because I think it's a particularly American ethic to be constantly busy. I looked up addiction in the in the dictionary, and the definition of addiction was pretty benign. It said that to be addicted is to, quote, devote or give oneself habitually or compulsively. And I would have to add that to be addicted is to continue this giving over of oneself despite negative results. We see this in addiction to alcohol or shopping or gambling. To give oneself, what a wonderful phrase. We want to give of ourselves. We want to give of ourselves to those we love, to our practice, to our sangha. But we all know that to give oneself to some kind of destructive obsession isn't healthy, and busyness is practically a requirement in our culture. You know, if we aren't busy, who are we? I think that too often in American society, we associate busyness with being productive. And I think it's really dangerous to feel that my worth as a human being depends on how productive I am at every moment. Now, I did teach kids for 35 years. So, I at night, I was always cutting out triangles or getting ready for the next day. A teacher's life teacher's work is never done. As a mom and a teacher, I was constantly multitasking, and I'm less prey to that now that I'm not working full time, although I'm still mentoring other teachers. But we can ask ourselves, are we being busy just to avoid being? And also, what are the negative results of our compulsive busyness? I'm sure a lot of us have noticed the corrosive, cell phones are so, what would we do without them? You know, I took a long time getting a cell phone. And then when my daughter finally forced me to get one so we could text each other, I thought, I'm just going to use this cell phone in case of emergency. And then, my definition of what emergency was really changed very, very quickly. That probably happened to you too. So while they're convenient, I think cell phones have somewhat eroded our quality of life, taking away our attention from what we're doing right now. You know, in my school, my heart would sink a little bit when a parent would be walking through the school hallway talking on their phone or texting, when there are all these children at their knees just looking for attention and validation and affection. We've all seen a table of people at a restaurant where each person is looking at their little screen. You know, before COVID, I went out for pizza with some young people and, people in their late 20s, early 30s. And I was very puzzled because they all put their cell phones in the middle of the table. And I said, why do you do that? And they said, well, the first person who reaches for their cell phone to text somebody or Google something has to pick up the tab, which I thought was a wonderful, deterrent, to picking up your phone. And by the way, nobody had to pick up the tab that night. We did Dutch that night. Busyness, I think, makes us less careful, less patient, less cognizant of one another's needs. I think when we're really busy and we're rushing around, we're more irritable, we're more prone to anger. And this busyness can actually erode our integrity and even edge us into a constant state of panic and dread and stress. So I've been thinking during this time of emergence from this shutdown, how can we translate the practice of Yunyan's non-busyness into everyday life as we go back to being busy again? And I think this is especially true when we're transplanting an Eastern way of thinking and being onto a Western culture where being busy is just a part of American life. I know that probably most of you are familiar with the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh. And I had the great pleasure of practicing with him in Southern France when my daughter was 11 years old. And we would walk very slowly through the sunflower fields that were right by the village there. And one of his assistants told me about being in Manhattan with Thich Nhat Hanh and walking with him in that very slow way down the sidewalk in Manhattan. Can you imagine how enraged everybody around them were? I mean, and also just stopping and staring at them, they might have well have been stark naked. It was so weird to see somebody walking that slowly. And I really smiled thinking about that. You know, given the demands most of us face, we'll probably continue to be busy. But our practice reminds us that even in the midst of our busyness, there is one who is not busy. And the crazier our world gets, the more I crave and treasure the simplicity, the refuge, the serenity, the tranquility of our sitting practice, which provides us with a kind of oasis in the midst of this crazy busy world. So I want to share with you some of the antidotes that I've thought about as a kind of answer to our obsessive busyness. And I'm sure you have some as well. First, our Zazen practice itself is an antidote to the habitual busyness that's so celebrated in our culture. This ancient practice of just sitting down in the midst of our life and simply being alive, feeling our breath as it arises and falls, feeling conscious contact with our seat, our sitting place. And this kind of quiet and stillness actually frees us to notice and make friends with this quiet witness within. And we can't do that until we consciously make a space for it in our lives. And I hope that in addition to your Sangha practice that you have a sitting practice in your own home as a kind of solace and reminder about the one who is not busy. You know, as a teacher, I brought this kind of practice to third graders, and, you know, I had a bell in my classroom like this, you know, one of our meditation bells. And I would ring that bell, or one of the students would ring it, and we just stop and take three deep breaths. And, you know, third graders, of course, thought this was really silly at first, and there'd be a lot of kind of sheepish embarrassment about it. But they came to really love having that, what they started calling the peace bell. And I have to tell you that, you know, some of them asked their parents to get a bell like that at home. And they tell me, you know, I ring that bell when my parents start fighting. And so I like to think of them being sabotaging the you know, domestic lack of tranquility in their own homes. Another thing that I think we can overlook is that we could come back to our breath during the day, not just during Zazen. And I think no matter how busy we are, we always have time to take three deep breaths. You might choose something as a kind of reminder to take three breaths. And for me, it's when I hear a siren, I take three breaths and I chant a little bit of the Metta Sutta, because when you hear a siren, someone somewhere is suffering. And that's a reminder of that. The ringing of your cell phone, you could take a deep breath. Or at a stoplight or stop sign, whenever you're forced to stop, to see that as an opportunity to take one or two or three deep breaths. Great thing to do at a staff meeting, by the way. Somebody asked me once how I got through staff meetings at school, which was not my favorite thing. I said, I always sit where I can see a tree outside the window. Now, a third thing we can do is to cultivate a feeling of spaciousness, even within a busy day. And I've retired from teaching kids, where I would have dozens of interactions every single day with adults and children. And when I was that busy as a teacher, I would often remind myself, I would say, I have all the time that I need. And I want to invite you to try saying that to yourself when you feel especially stressed or busy. Just remind yourself, I have all the time that I need. Because if you notice, usually by the time you get to the end of the day, you've taken care of the important things. And it helps you feel a little spaciousness around things if you can remind yourself, I have all the time that I need. And also walking slowly at work, not as slowly as Thich Nhat Hanh, but, you know, not as quickly as we usually do. Actually, that was my fourth thing, to walk slowly during the day and consciously meet each person and event wholeheartedly. It's hard to do that when we're rushing around, right? To really meet each person. A fifth thing that we can do in the midst of our busy lives is just leave a little bit earlier than we normally would. I was somebody who was always chronically late. I think it was a kind of passive aggression in my earlier life, kind of a power trip to be the last one to arrive. Somebody told me it's hard to be right on time, but it's easy to be early. And when I took up this practice of trying to be early rather than rushing to be right on time, it gave me that sense of spaciousness in my life. A sixth thing to do is to try to build moments of peacefulness and joy into your everyday life. For me, at school, I used to go into the music room during recess and play the piano. And I didn't have a piano in my home, but I'm so happy I recently bought a Yamaha keyboard with 88 keys. It looks and feels like just like a real piano. And it has headphones so that I don't pester my quiet Buddhist neighbors with my piano playing. And it's been such a joy to come back to these simple pieces I learned as a child. Another one that I've been doing lately is just drawing. You know, if you sit down right in front of something and try to draw it, it really brings you into the present moment. And you might be surprised by what you see when you sit down and draw what's right in front of you. A wonderful thing we can do for ourselves that's kind of gotten lost in our culture is to, number seven, plan a Sabbath for yourself. Now, this won't happen unless you really schedule it, that on Sunday or Saturday or whatever day you have free, I'm going to do pretty much nothing, you know. Now, what I mean by pretty much nothing is maybe sleep late, you know, have a cup of coffee in bed, read, nap, listen to music, stare out the window, watch birds, work in the garden, cook something from scratch. So I don't mean absolutely nothing. That would be a one-day sitting. But, but you know, a very quiet day of very low-key activity. And ideally, if you can do that by yourself and have some much-needed serenity and solitude even in the midst of your family life. An eighth thing is exercising. Not out of some sense of virtue or to look great, your best even, but just for the sensual pleasure of moving through space. And I'm very close to Golden Gate Park, and I walk in the park almost every day. And to watch the very subtle seasons we have in California has been enormously beautiful, watching the buds come out. And at Stowe Lake right now in Golden Gate Park, the great blue herons are nesting in the trees there and building and feeding their little fledglings there in their nests. When we slow down and really look around us, there are so many riches that we might overlook if we were rushing. I've saved the ninth one for my favorite, which is to be around trees. I taught third graders about trees and have studied trees. There's so much wonderful research out now about trees and how they look like they're just standing still. You know, a tree plants itself in the life it finds itself in, but it sends down deep roots and gives back so much. You know, trees give us shade and fruit and of course oxygen and medicine and beauty. And we're finding out now that just as in a Buddhist Sangha, we feed and nurture one another in this very quiet and persistent way, They're finding that trees communicate chemically with one another through their leaves and also through their roots, with an incredible fungal network where they share nutrients with one another. But just to put all the science aside and just sit under a tree with your back resting against its sturdy trunk, I think you can absorb some of the wonderful stillness and generosity of trees. Now, the last thing I want to share with you, and I bet you do this sometimes because I know I do, we can stop talking about how busy and stressed out we are. It's so tempting when someone says, "How are you?" to say, "Oh, I'm so busy," and, you know, catalog all the many, many things we're doing and accomplishing. And it's so refreshing, you know, to maybe turn that back and find out something about that other person that you didn't know. Or a really wonderful thing would be to share some joyous thing you saw on your walk through the park that day, or something beautiful and moving that's occurred to you recently. Instead of, you know, because every time we say, "Oh, I'm so busy, I'm so stressed out," we're deepening that neural pathway in our brain that tells us, yes, we are stressed out. So these 10 points are things that I think are things that I'm turning towards myself that I wanted to share with you. I also want to share with you this poem, which will, I think, help sustain me as I begin to return to normal life, whatever that is. I hope we don't return to our normal American life. I hope we've learned something from all the upheavals we've had this year. But this poem is called "As Much As You Can," and it's by a Greek poet, C.P. Kavafy. That's C-A-V-A-F-Y. "As Much As You Can." Even if you can't shape your life the way you want, at least try as much as you can not to cheapen it totally by too much contact with the world and all its traffic and talk. Don't degrade it by dragging it along, taking it around and exposing it so often to the daily silliness of meetings and parties, until it comes to seem unbearable, no longer your own. I'm going to ring this bell right now, and let's take 3 breaths together, shall we? I know these bells don't sound as beautiful on Zoom. I think many of us long for a simpler way of life, and we've tasted that a bit this past year. Part of this practice can be just remembering to return to the present moment, the simplicity of just doing the next thing in front of us. My first Buddhist teacher, Richard Baker Roshi, said that if you feel overwhelmed, if you don't know what to do, do the dishes. You know, I think this was his version of chop wood, carry water. In other words, to just do something that needs to be done, that's calling to us from our immediate environment, a physical activity that will change the way we feel and change what's around us, even in a subtle way. And I know that Thich Nhat Hanh talks about doing the dishes as if you're washing a baby. And what a different experience it is to wash dishes as if you're washing a baby, instead of rushing through that activity to get to the next thing, which I think we often do. I notice a lot of people getting rid of excess stuff these days. You see it out on the sidewalks in San Francisco. You know, rethinking our living space and enjoying the simplicity of gardening and reading and home cooking. All of these kinds of activities do invite us to slow down, and enjoy our life more deeply, to take a break from running around like crazy and thinking that our worth as a human being depends on how busy we are. We might have this sense of spending too much time in our heads, worrying about the future or regretting something buried in the past, worrying about, oh my goodness, the health of our own country and the discouraging and disheartening and painful things that come to light every day around us. But we need to nurture ourselves when we're feeling the pain of those things. And one antidote to that kind of mental busyness and distress is to return to the present moment. Someone I know who's subject to panic attacks told me that one way he deals with a panic attack is just to tell himself, right now, I'm okay. Right now, I'm okay. And also to look down and see his feet planted in the ground. You know, to literally get that sense of grounding. Jim mentioned, I'm really happy that I was able to jump into this project of writing Buddhist children's books. I was invited by Shambhala Publishing to write books for kids about Buddhist practice. And it's been a very interesting koan for me, because at Zen Center, at least, we don't indoctrinate kids into Zen or make them sit still with us. But there are many things that we do with children, like they join us in silence at the beginning of meals, and we have a family day at Green Gulch at the beginning of each month where children come and they sit in on the lecture. The first 10 or 15 minutes is often a fairy tale or a story geared to children that then relates to the following Dharma talk. So writing these books for kids has been such a nice way for me to be in touch with my love of children, and also blending my love for children and what I've learned from them by being with them for half my life. You know, this story comes to mind, one of my favorite stories of teaching. And Blanche Hartman, those of you who knew Blanche, really loved this story. I was sitting at my desk one day during silent sustained reading, and this little boy, Nathan Miller, was walking by my desk, and all of a sudden he did this crazy little dance. And I called him over. I said, "Nathan, what were you thinking about right then?" He goes, "Laura, do you ever forget you're alive and all of a sudden you remember?" And I was so blown away that I was there for his enlightenment experience. You know, I said, "Yeah, that happens to me too." So it was a challenge and a koan and a joy to write the book I finished recently, which is a book about Zen for kids. And I titled it Tigers and Teacups, Zen Stories, Poems, and Practices for Kids and Their Families. And I don't know if Shambhala will stick with that title, but I like it. It's not going to be out for quite a while because it takes a long time for these things to get illustrated. But I just submitted my manuscript with stories that will appeal to kids and some activities for them to do. And if you'll indulge me, one of these chapters is about doing the next thing, you know, taking care of things. And I thought it'd be fun to share with you both what I said to kids about taking care of things. And as we think about, as adults, we think about our obsessive busyness and the way we can scatter our energy with too much stuff to take care of and too much worry. Zen Flesh, Zen Bones might have been the very first book I ever came across. And it's such a beautiful little text. It still enlightens every day. And I took a few very brief stories from that book and rewritten them and have rewritten and expanded them for kids. This is how I introduced this story to children, taking care of things. An important part of Zen is learning how to take care of things. The things we use every day take good care of us, and we should take good care of them. A good cook takes care of his knives because he couldn't prepare food without their help. a good carpenter takes care of her tools because she couldn't build things without their help. Cooks and carpenters keep their knives and tools clean, and they put them back in the same place each time they use them so that they're there when they need them again. There's a saying in Zen, chop wood, carry water, which means every day, pay attention to what you're doing and take care of things. In this story, a young monk enters the temple. This story is called Wash Your Bowl. There was a young man who longed to enter the monastery so that he could practice Zen. He had heard tales of the great Zen masters, and he wanted to be just like them, to be able to sit still with a calm mind and to grow in his knowledge and compassion. He set off with just the clothes on his back and made his way up into the high mountains. The crooked path led him to a Zen temple, and he sat outside for 3 days facing a wall, hoping that the Zen master would notice him and let him practice there. On the evening of the third day, Master Joshu silently slid open the wooden door of the temple and invited the young monk to enter. It happened to be time for the evening meal, so the young man slipped off his shoes and put them neatly on the shoe rack, entered the zendo, sat down, and silently ate a bowl of rice porridge with the other monks. When he was done, he approached the master and said, "I've just entered the monastery. Will you teach me?" Joshu answered, "Have you eaten your rice porridge?" The young monk answered, "Yes, master, I have eaten." Joshu said, "Then you had better wash your bowl." At that moment, the young monk was enlightened. Thank you very much for your kind attention. And we have some time for questions and discussion. I would love to hear what jewels you found in the darkness during this past year, and how you find ease and joy in the midst of your necessary busyness. You know, again, none of us would have wished for a global pandemic and all the loss and grief that it's caused, but is there something that you've learned or enjoyed during this time that you want to make sure to remember as things begin to open up? I just thought of Nathan saying, "Do you ever forget you're alive?" And all of a sudden you remember again. So the floor is open for your comments. And you probably know that there's a reaction button at the bottom of the screen where you can raise your hand. It's a little bit easier to see that if it's virtual. If you'd like to offer something to the group. Will, let's hear from Will.
I feel a kindred spirit with you. I'm a high school teacher myself, so felt very much aligned with all that you said. But I do like how you opened with the case 21 about sweeping. That's one practice that I just took up recently, is to wake up in the morning and sweep the kitchen floor and the living room floor, whether it needed it or not. And that takes me out of my grogginess. It renews my mind. It's just so refreshing to do something so simple. And it just wakes me up. It's really a great practice.
Thank you for that, Will. Maybe a lot of you will be sweeping tomorrow morning. hi, Clement.
Thank you so much for your talk. I enjoyed it immensely. The thing that I am... enjoyed about the shutdown, if it's, I live not far from a very busy intersection, and my wife and I both, after a few days, noticed how quiet it had become. It was reminiscent of used to live in northern Nevada, and it would snow, and the entire city would quiet down, and it was just lovely. And the
Clement, you're coming in and out a little bit. I wonder if you stopped your video, we'd hear you better.
And I live not too far from a hospital. In the, okay, try that.
Yeah, sometimes that helps. Yeah.
But, is it working now?
Yeah.
The quiet.
Ironically, you're very quiet right now.
It's very refreshing. And, okay. I'll leave it.
Okay, you might put something in the chat if you like. Hi, Biba.
Hi. This is my first time here. So I really enjoyed your talk. I think what stood out to me the most was the anger part, you know, when you're working too much. Mm-hmm. But I would say what I think of a lot of good habits despite everything. It's actually been very positive for me. I started doing word search and puzzles. I started spending more time with my family. We all play this game together. It's called Jackbox. I don't know if you guys know, but even when I look at my pets, I appreciate them more. Like, because I'm working from home, I even notice my pets looking at me different because I'm there more. Yeah. So it's like, I feel like I've gained so much more of like a grounding and an appreciation during this, you know. And although there's been a lot of bad, it's actually, I think every spiritual person who really practices enjoyed quarantine, you know. So yeah,
it's
nice to meet everybody.
Thank you, Biba.
We
hope you come back. It's been a kind of monastic time, hasn't it? Hi, Dusk.
Hello. I really enjoyed your talk, especially the parts about how we are so busy. I talk a lot about productivity to other people and talking about how, you know, capitalism makes us feel like our worth is tied in with our productivity. And it's not, you know, your worth as a person, it's inherent, you know, because you're a person. It has nothing to do with how productive you are. And I'm very against work. I'm like an anti-work communist. So I'm very against productivity as a concept. I think it's one of the horrible things about capitalism. But there's my little rant. But I was just going to say the quarantine really taught me, you know, how meaningless everything out there was. You know, everything out there was, in the grand scheme of things, not that important. You know, right before I lost my job and I felt like the world was ending, but then, you know, the longer I was inside, the more I realized how little it really matters in the grand scheme of things. You know, people are losing their lives and their loved ones. And it, in the grand scheme of things, my life is not as bad as I thought it was. And I actually ended up changing my name during quarantine and really embracing who I am as a trans person, which was really healing for me because I've been out for like 5 years, but even though I was out, I felt like almost only semi out, like the closet door was half open basically, because people would still misgender me and I wouldn't say anything. And I kept my old name to please my parents and all that stuff. So I finally just like let it all go and became my true self. So that's what I learned over the quarantine. And thank you again for your talk. It was beautiful.
Thank you, Dusk. You know, I want to say how refreshing it was to hear our President Biden, give a shout out to transgender youth and say that he's got your back, you know? I mean, that's such a night and day change from what we've been living with for so long. I'm going to put my Dharma sister Karen on the spot, because Karen and I have been practicing together for a long time. So Karen, I'm going to call you out, girl.
Oh, gee, you're a meanie. Well, this period has been hard for me, actually. And I've found that I feel kind of anxious, almost too anxious to settle into drawing. So actually, I mean, you were very inspiring to suggest that to actually just do what I think I should do, which is sit down and draw every day, or at least more often than I do. But, you know, I've been doing a lot of cooking, and I think I'm just paying more attention to that. And mm-hmm. not so much gardening, but landscape at least, and doing things around the house, taking walks, looking at birds, you know, doing more of what I have always liked to do, but it is quieter for sure.
I really Thanks, Karen.
Appreciate
yeah.
your talk. Thank you.
For those who may not know, Karen is a gifted artist. I have some of her beautiful work. Thanks, Karen. Jim, I'm going to call on you.
Oh, good. Yeah, that I was just going to put my hand up.
Uh-huh.
What it seemed like the pandemic to me was a cold stop, and at first it felt quite uncomfortable. And then I started to get into it, and I found that I actually dropped, some things that I could have kept doing, but I don't know why. Like I play music, some of the time, and for me, I just stopped playing music, and I don't know why, but I just didn't feel like it. And part of it was that I couldn't, some friends who I would play with started having music on Zoom, and I just didn't appeal to me to try to play music that way. Cause we did it the same way that we talked to each other on Zoom, where one person plays and the other people are muted and they play along, but you can't hear them, you know?
Yeah,
it just didn't appeal to me, so I stopped that, and then recently I was studying Spanish, and I've been studying Spanish for 10 years, and I stopped studying Spanish too. So it's been actually great just to have more space in my life, more time, and I have read a couple of novels, which I hadn't been doing. I haven't been reading for pleasure very much. And so, yeah, there's been a shift towards just being quieter and more, less gaining mind, I think, about, you know, trying to accomplish this and that, trying to become a better musician, trying to, you know, have an idea that I could become fluent in Spanish, you know, just kind of dropping it and just, you know, not worrying about it. So. It's been you spoke about the kind of silver lining aspects. To me, that's what it's been. It's just less gaining mind, less anxious about accomplishment. So
yes, thank you for that. Hello, Meg.
So I have two ways that the pandemic has and this quarantine has affected me. One has been my work. Prior to the quarantine, I spent my days out on the road and visiting patients and sitting with them, and really found it meaningful work. But the pandemic, because of my age, forced me to not be allowed to go out. So I was doing my work from home and calling the families and have realized that we, by calling just to report on how their loved one is doing, we're missing a huge piece of the work that we could be doing in terms of the compassionate care for the families whose, and it became really, really powerful to be there for people who were isolated and isolated from their loved ones. It made my, give it a different meaning, and I think will change my work forever. The other really amazing thing is that 3 weeks before the pandemic, I walked into Valley Streams. Ooh, I didn't expect that. And this Sangha has become to mean so much to me. I was a regular meditator, probably 3 or 4 days a week. I'm now meditating every morning and every evening. I've come to treasure the silence of sitting on my cushion. I've come to treasure this group of people and what I'm learning from them. It has been just an amazing year for me spiritually, for me spending time in the quiet, our day sits, our study. And I don't know that I would have been as regular about getting my butt downtown. And I just want to thank everybody in the Sangha for what you've come to mean to me and what I've learned from you. Thank you.
Thank you, Meg. Let's hear from Peter.
I'm amused that Jim shared music and languages, because I have been using those two topics quite a bit during the lockdown, on the condition that I'm really not going to get there. I'm not going to become a good musician. I'm not going to become good at Japanese and or French, the two languages I study daily. But I do it as an exercise of, this is what to do. It's kind of fun for me, especially piano, which I've been studying since 1972. And I just sit there, and I particularly enjoy working on Felix Mendelssohn and Keith Jarrett's work. And I just take it really slowly. And that's where I sit. I don't sit and meditate often without the help of a sangha, but I do play the piano 1 to 3 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And I go really slowly at it. And I give myself permission to not progress, but to still stay with it and just keep playing with it. Same with the language, like working with the kanji, but mostly hiragana and the katakana in the three alphabets of Japanese, or French, which I've been studying more for several decades because I'm a bicyclist. And it's really fun to give myself permission to not have to feel progress.
Well, thank you for that, Peter. I think the bumper sticker for tonight is, give yourself permission to not progress. Yay! That is terrific. Take that pressure off. I like that. Well, does anyone else want to jump in here? Hi, Richard.
Hello. Thank you for your talk. I really enjoyed it. You know, when you're talking about, taking time out to, you know, just relax and slow down. And, you know, I think it's interesting, because for me, you know, I don't know, I feel my you know, don't want to be harsh on myself, but I feel my natural feeling is to, you know, or I used to say to myself when I was younger that, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I like being lazy. and, you know, and I always thought that was a bad word. And then later, as like an IT guy or a programmer, you know, I must have read one time someone said, oh, the best programmer is the lazy programmer. And I was just like, oh, that's interesting, because you want to do things in such a way the first time that you just reuse your code over and over again. So you don't want to do more work later on. You want to do less work. This what you know, and the more organized you are with your code, the less work you have to do later, because it's easier to read. You know, you can reuse it. And so, yeah, I often think that that's interesting. Like, you know, lazy can just be a smart use of your time if you do it right. I did during COVID, you know, I found myself in a situation with all the things that were happening, you know, with the multiple deaths and, you know, and the protests. You know, I felt at one point, I think there was like a good week or two where, you know, I was just barely doing enough for work. And I was talking to my acupuncturist and, you know, she said, oh, how are you doing? And I was like, you know, I'm feeling like I didn't really do much this week. And she said, well, that's okay. You're allowed not to do much. And I was like, oh, well, it feels kind of bad. You know, just like you said, sometimes it feels bad not to be busy. And I like that you talked about it, because I do feel like that's a very, I'm not sure if it's just an American thing, maybe it's a Western thing, but you know, I do think as Americans, we pride ourselves on hard work. And, you know, and I do think that's a cultural thing sometimes. You know, you said when you're younger, you're like to be late. I too like to be fashionably late, or as they say, fashionably on time. and, you know, I do think sometimes that's a cultural thing. You know, like I find other cultures are very much, time is a suggestion. You know, so it's like, oh, you say 9, people trickle in around 9:30, 10, you know, whereas it seems that there's more of a Western thing. It's 9, that means you're there at 8:50, you know. lastly, I like to talk about things I've done in COVID. I think just like Meg, you know, I find myself, you know, I was going to the Sangha, but, you know, with working from home and all the Zoom meetings or all the Zoom sanghas and also the Zoom retreats, you know, I found Valley Stream Sangha as well as, you know, POC Sangha I go to. I feel like it's been, you know, the practice has been very helpful, you know, and, you know, I know Zoom is a little awkward as in having a community, but, you know, seeing people, seeing the Sangha members in Valley Streams during the week, twice a week, because I do the book study, you know, it's like sometimes I see the Sangha members more than I see my own family and talk to my own family. So, you know, it's very comforting. So, yes, practice has definitely grown over COVID. And, you know, it's probably because everything has slowed down and I have more time to do things. And just like Jim, I stopped reading science fiction and fantasy for a while, and I've gotten back into reading some nice, interesting novels. And I don't know why COVID has brought reading nonfiction. I mean, not fiction, fiction again. You know, I think I got into my nonfiction phase for a while. And so, yeah, doing a lot more enjoyable reading. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Richard. I think maybe that's a good place to stop. Really appreciate everything you shared and having an opportunity to share this time with you. So thank you.